And now, with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved, here is Dr. James Houck.
Okay, well, good afternoon, everybody. Well, wherever you are in the world at this time, welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, finding one's courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. And I truly believe that from the bottom of my heart, just personally and professionally. I am very happy to be with you here today at every Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Standard Time. Each and every week, these broadcasts focus on the integration of spirituality and our mental health, and that they're all placed within the context of our relationships, the relationship that we have with ourselves, the relationships that we have with others, and certainly our relationship that we have with God or the divine. And there's a very specific reason why I place this kind of integration in relationships. Because, again, I am a firm believer that just as we go through life, we often receive our deepest physical, emotional, psychological, even spiritual wounds in relationships. And yet we can also discover our greatest healing and strength and peace and forgiveness and love through healthier relationships. And this is often just the irony of life, that which wounds, we also find that that can be a source of our healing as a result. And these relationships just might even be within our own families or our coworkers or even our friends. Because whenever we transform, whenever we go through something transformational, whenever there's a shift or change in us, we also transform others by our presence and through grace and through understanding. But first, forgiveness, kindness, and compassion begins with how we treat ourselves. Because when we are compassionate with ourselves, then we can be compassionate with others. And when we are more forgiving with ourselves, I find that we can be more forgiving with others. And when we are able to live in gratitude with ourselves and just approach life with that gratitude and thankfulness, we then discover how this often opens our hearts to see and live in gratitude with others. So all in all, transformation first and foremost begins with us. Or as Henry Nouwen puts it, just by paying attention to what is going on around us, we discover that there are people who heal each other's wounds and forgive each other's offenses and share their possessions and foster the spirit of community, and celebrate the gifts that they have and live in constant anticipation of the full manifestation of God's glory. Well, I am Dr. James Houck, and if you would like more information about me, or maybe you want to leave me some comments about today's show, just invite you to visit the website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. Again, that's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And just in case you're not able to stay with me the full hour and you want to go back and listen again, these shows are podcasted, so you can go back into the archives and you can listen to the previous shows. So if you are so inclined and you would like to call in and be part of today's broadcast, I also invite you to call in on the toll-free line, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And when you call in, I ask that you would give me your insights or your comments or your thoughts on today's subject. And that is, we sat down by the river and wept. Okay. Well, for those of you who might be tuning in for the very first time, just welcome aboard. Thank you. Always like to have first-time listeners. But I'd just also like to share a little bit more about myself, and that I am a firm believer that all of us come into this world already equipped and graced with everything we need for this life, especially in terms of our giftedness or our skills and our talents, say our strengths, our character traits, personality, and so forth. And yet, sometimes as we go through life, and maybe due to some unpleasant experiences, we are very tempted to hide the very best parts of ourselves from others. Perhaps as children or teenagers or young adults, we were very free about showing others our giftedness, our talents, our skills, our strengths, and so forth. But, you know, maybe something happened that we needed to hide these things, or we felt like we needed to hide these things, or we push, let's say, our giftedness way, way down so others cannot see it. Because perhaps we went through an experience in which these very best parts of ourselves were exploited. Or, you know, the classic example is perhaps we were told that we would never amount to anything, or whatever other voice we heard, you know, telling us that there's nothing special to us. And then, therefore, we didn't even bother to look any further. We just thought that there was nothing new to us, so there must be nothing more to explore. And we just kind of dropped an anchor, so to speak, in life, and just, you know, swallowed that message, which was very detrimental. And we just kind of went on autopilot. And, you know, we realized that, you know, the best parts of ourselves, we didn't even give a chance for them to come out. But at any rate, when we don't realize the very best parts of ourselves, or we don't realize the giftedness, or we don't embrace our strengths and so forth, we tend to go through life functioning from this place of woundedness, or a place of victimhood, or a place of, well, you know, you can't expect too much from me because this is where I came from. Or again, whatever excuse or message we heard growing up that just robbed the very best of ourselves. And as I said, we function in our relationships from this place of being wounded, or, you know, playing the victim, instead of functioning from a place of healing or wholeness. Or, you know, and embracing our hachetas, our uniqueness. So, again, welcome. I thank you for listening for today, because this is an interesting time in which we live. As you were watching the news perhaps yesterday, you realize that on March 11th was the, on the grand scale, shutdown, lockdown, whatever you want to call it, because of the pandemic. You know, because of COVID, and many people were either laid off or let go from work, restaurants shut down, kids were off schools, schools closed down, and so forth. And COVID just really started to impact every entity, agency, organization that we could think of. And even though it's been a year, it feels like it's been longer. And maybe that's just me. Maybe it just feels like we've been at this for another 3 or 5 years. And even though we have some vaccines that are rolling out and so forth, and perhaps, hopefully, we've learned some lessons along the way, we still have a long way to go. I just think that whenever the dust settles, and whenever this new normal is going to take place, whatever that's going to look like, it's going to also create this huge learning curve for us. Because we still, you know, we still have this sense of just a huge uncertainty hanging over our heads as to, like, what is going to be the full implication of having gone through something like this. But at any rate, I've often said that going through, you know, national tragedies or crises in a community, or even within families, you know, there's the old saying of that which doesn't kill me makes me stronger. And that is true. I prefer the saying, Sometimes what we go through brings out the worst in us, but it also brings out the best in us. And we've heard stories of both sides, the worst in people and the best in people. And so this is, where we are in society in terms of, what do we look for? What hope do we hold out for one another? And do we see the potential for things to get better, or the potential in one another to encourage each other to bring out the very best parts of ourselves? Okay. Well, over the past couple of weeks and leading up to this broadcast, as I was putting the materials together, I've been reminded almost to the point of every day, if not every other day, about society's messages regarding shedding tears. Okay? What's society's message out there regarding people who cry? Or why does a person cry? Or so forth. And if we're honest with ourselves, over this past year, with COVID shut down and the number of deaths related to this pandemic, we've had a lot to cry about. And rightly so. Because whenever we experience the loss of a loved one, or whenever we're overcome with strong emotions, tears are just a natural way our bodies release this built-up tension, or just release, just the emotions that are just, getting ready to overflow. Well, let's go back into Mr. Whoopi's time machine, shall we? And if you know what I'm talking about, that means you're old, okay? you're not that old, all right? But let's go back into Mr. Whoopi's time machine. And do you remember a song entitled "Don't Cry Out Loud" by Melissa Manchester? I think it was the 70s or so when it came out. I'm not going to sing it for you because, well, that'll be interesting. But I'll share with you just the refrain, and you'll get the message here. And she sings, "Don't cry out loud, just keep it inside, and learn how to hide your feelings. Fly high and proud, and if you should fall, remember you almost had it all." Interesting. Okay. And now that you have that tune stuck in your head, let's go to another song that also talks about hiding our tears. You remember the group Quarterflash? Okay, this will take you back to the 80s, so it's really not that long ago. But the song is "Harden My Heart." And the lead singer at the time, she sang, "I'm going to harden my heart. I'm going to swallow my tears. I'm going to turn and leave you here." I mean, and these were very popular songs. And I don't know if people got caught up with the tune, the melody, or they actually listened to the words that were being sung, or maybe we just sang along just out of habit. But that also had an impact on, society's, shall we say, expectation about tears in general. Okay, and hopefully we've learned enough by now through research and other studies that were done, just in the physical sense, just how detrimental that is to our physical health if we swallow those tears, or if we hide our tears, if we don't let others see us cry, but we stuff those feelings way, way down. Because I'll share with you coming up here that a very important study that was done back in the 1940s, right around the time of World War II, that just interesting connection that was made regarding unresolved grief issues or unresolved pain in our lives, and how that just affects us physically, especially when it comes to our stomach, when it comes to our gastrointestinal tract, our GI tract. Okay? Well, society has many definitions or, many messages out there regarding tears. And one of the messages that I just, I have to, hold my head together so it doesn't explode, is this notion that big boys don't cry. Okay? Big boys don't cry. I mean, I can't believe that message is still out there after everything that we've learned. And that message, for me, ranks right up there with, men don't eat quiche, which is, I think, a joke because, how about we just change that message to, well, real men will eat whatever they want to eat without worrying about what others might think of them. That's certainly a healthier message out there. Yeah, okay. Well, a lot of times we cannot express our feelings any other way except for tears. I mean, we go through something and it's very painful, it's very hurtful, and we simply just can't put those emotions into words. And, all we can do is sob. All we can do is weep. And, that's all we can do. And I've had clients who just in front of me, they touch on something very meaningful for their life. And it doesn't have to be something earth-shattering, horrific. It could be something very joyful, a time of celebration. And they're touched in a certain way in which tears just well up inside of them. And, they're sitting in front of me and they're just sobbing away. And they can't put it into words. And after a while, just sitting in silence with them, and they are coming around and they feel like talking again, I just typically ask a question, if those tears could talk, what would they say? If those tears could talk, what would they say? Okay. Well, have you ever noticed that there is this temptation, either by society or just people in general, to explain why a person is crying, or why is a person sad? I've seen this many times when people begin to cry or they begin to shed a few tears, that they often apologize. Okay, they would say, "I'm sorry, I don't mean to be so emotional," or something, and it's like there's nothing to apologize for. You're human. You will cry. You will shed tears. In fact, it's very cathartic to be able to do this. But I'm sure there's also other moments where you've seen that, as soon as a person begins to lose it with their tears, they're often whisked away into another room, away from the crowd, away from others, or they're often given a box of tissues, which sends an underlying message of, "I'm uncomfortable with your tears, so please dry them. Please compose yourself," and again, that message, is tied in with other messages from society that we have to hide our tears for some reason so we don't offend somebody else or we don't make them uncomfortable or God forbid, what happens if they start crying? Well, okay, they start crying. There's plenty more tissues to go around. But this is certainly normal and a normal response to somebody who cries, okay? But it's also surprising, as I've noticed this throughout my years, how many people want to have some sort of ready-made pat answer for anything, especially when they hear or see the strong emotions of others. That just makes them very uncomfortable or they don't know what else to say. So it's just like, well, whatever happened is God's will or something like that, which does not do anything for the person. These pat answers just do not provide the level of comfort that we think, they ought to convey. Because most of the time it says more about us being uncomfortable. I would rather have somebody, and I've seen this too, but I'd rather have somebody, if I'm in that state of shedding tears, just to come up to me, look me in the eyes, and just say, "I don't know what to say, but I care." I mean, that's very therapeutic right there, okay? I really don't know what to say. I don't have the words, but I care. Okay? And give me a hug. Okay? You know, and again, I've seen that in the numerous funerals I've attended and so forth. It works. It provides that genuine sense of comfort and grace in the moment when words are not even necessary. In fact, words will do more harm than good. It's because they tend to spoil, you know, what's going on in the moment, because words just cannot capture everything that we're feeling. Okay? Well, I would imagine everybody out there, whether or not you're religious, okay, I'm sure everybody out there is familiar with the story of Job in the Bible, okay? Or, you know, if somebody's very patient, you know, you might be referred to as having the patience of Job, all right? Well, for those of you who are unfamiliar with the story of Job, Job lived long time ago, long, long time ago. All right. And we kind of get the backstory at the beginning of the story where, you know, God and the devil are just talking one day, and the devil makes a dare to God, saying that, look, the only reason why Job is prospering is because you have him protected. But if you are not protecting him and let me take a crack at him, he will definitely curse you to your face. Well, God takes that bet. Okay, and, you know, God doesn't protect Job, and the devil just starts inflicting all kinds of pain on him, and yet Job holds on to his integrity. Job does not curse God. Job does not shake his finger at God, and this just irritates the devil even more, which is kind of funny right there, but Job suffered tremendously. I mean, just horrific, gut-wrenching, physical, emotional, psychological, and spiritual suffering. And word got out that Job was just in a very, 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 very bad way. And he was suffering tremendously. And as the story goes, Job's three friends showed up. Because I guess they wanted to see for themselves, you know, just what's going on with our friends. And so they came to him when he was in this, you know, horrific state of suffering. And they did the best thing that anybody could do in that moment. They sat down beside their best friend and they wept with him. And that's it. That's all they needed to do. And for 7 days... 1 week, 7 days, they remained present and silent with their friend. However, and this is where the story gets interesting, after 7 days, they do one of the worst things that we could do to anybody who is suffering. They decided to talk. And they didn't just talk, but they felt the need to kind of explain to Job why he was suffering the way he did. And it provided no comfort to him whatsoever, but it didn't matter to them. They just kept talking to him and try to offer him explanations. Okay, so for example, his first friend said to him, and I'm paraphrasing here, you know, Job, God doesn't really punish people like this unless, you know, you've done something, you know, horribly wrong. And of course, that didn't bring Job any comfort, because he's like, well, I don't know what I did, so if I did something, show it to me. But nobody could show Job what he did, because really Job didn't do anything wrong. And the second friend, he decided to weigh in on, you know, his theological stance on this, and he says, you know, Job, God is merciful. We all know this. So why don't you just confess your sins and ask for forgiveness, and God will stop torturing you like this. And Job replied, you know, again, I don't know what I did, so how can I ask for forgiveness when something, I don't even know if I did it, okay? And now, if it wasn't bad enough, the third friend comes along and he says to Job, you think this is suffering? You ain't seen nothing yet. God's just getting started with you. And finally, Job just couldn't take it anymore. And he just shouted at his friends, and he says, you know, all of you, you are miserable comforters. you know, or maybe in today's language, we would say, look, you're a miserable comforter, so just get away from me, okay, with friends like you, you know. But have you ever been so overcome with an emotion that all you felt like doing was just sitting down and having a good cry? We've all been there, okay? I mean, I'm talking about like a deep, heavy, sobbing cry, you know, whereby afterwards you felt completely drained and exhausted, and all you simply wanted to do was sleep. Well, we all do. We've all been there. Again, you know, I remember seeing a lot of research studies that focus on, you know, just exactly what is released when we shed tears. Well, there's one study by Dr. William Fry. Actually, he was an Alzheimer's researcher. I believe it was St. Paul, Minnesota. And he studied tears back in the early 80s. And his conclusion was that tears stirred up by our emotions contain high levels of protein and manganese, that the normal teary fluid that protects and lubricates our eyes. And in fact, tears have more of these levels of proteins and manganese than just this normal fluid that just keeps, our eyes moist. And certainly, strong emotions bring on crying. But crying also seems to release built-up stress and tension. And other researchers in this area have also noted that crying releases neurotransmitters. You know, oxytocin and endorphins, which are very positive to us, which ease both not only our physical pain, but also our emotional pain. So there is research out there that backs the notion that it's very healthy to cry, to shed these tears. In fact, this is why I believe we're given tears on this side of heaven, if you will. Okay, because, you know, we're going to go through things sooner or later in which we're going to experience pain or disappointment, or we could be overcome with joy to the point of tears and so forth. Okay, but since these studies have come out, there's also numerous surveys and questionnaires that have really reported that a lot of people feel much better after having a good cry. Okay. And in fact, there was one large international study. I think it had like over 4,200 young adults from about 32 countries. And again, these surveys and questionnaires reported that these people not only felt better mentally after crying compared to how they felt afterwards. And about 40%, well, they said they felt the same, and only about 10%. Felt worse. Okay. Well, as I mentioned, let's go back into the time machine here in the 1942. And this is groundbreaking work that, why it's important to cry and to resolve pain and suffering in our lives. It was thanks to Dr. Eric Linderman. He was working in Massachusetts General Hospital in the 1940s, and he was actually treating people for ulcerative colitis. And one of the things that he had noticed was the importance for people to resolve their grief issues. In fact, he would sit and talk with people, and they often said to him that they had just some unresolved issues in their life, but that was giving them ulcerative colitis. Okay, but here's where the story gets really interesting, because about 9 months later, Dr. Linderman, he observed the grief reactions of those who lost loved ones in the Coconut Grove nightclub fire. right there, just outside, the Massachusetts General Hospital. And it was just a very, very tragic fire indeed. It was, it was a nightclub. And so there was just a lot of, like cabana things and up and palm trees and so forth. And rumor has it that one of the waiters just flicked a cigarette into one of the plants. And then, of course, it caught fire and the whole place went up. Very, very quickly, and many, many people died and they perished in that fire. And so, again, about 8-9 months later, Dr. Lindemann was seeing their loved ones, who had lost, people in their life during this nightclub fire. And he was treating them for, yes, ulcerative colitis, because they had a hard time in working through their loss and grief. In fact, a lot of them just didn't know how to cry. A lot of them felt like they needed to hide their tears. And all that pain and that suffering and that loss and that really strong, strong grief emotions, which are normal for anybody who would go through a circumstance like this to feel, it just landed right there in the GI tract. And then just colitis. Okay. And this is very important for us to understand that the body is often the first thing that's going to react to, situations or circumstances in which we just have strong emotions. And if we are unable to release because we feel like we need to swallow our tears, or we need to hide our tears, or we minimize our tears because we might be thinking, well, there's other people out there who are worse off than me, and I'll just go around with a stiff upper lip, and I'll just hold it in because that's actually a source of strength. And we find out that that's not what makes a person strong. But to be able to embrace our emotions, to embrace when things are getting overwhelming and embrace our tears and to make no apologies for them. Okay. Well, I would really love to hear your heart on this matter, this subject. So, again, if you want to call in, I invite you to do so by calling the toll-free number, 888-627-6008, and I will be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I am your host, Dr. James Houck, and I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Welcome back. I am Dr. James Houck, and you have been listening to, and you still are listening to, I should say, Reclaiming Authenticity. Again, I just before we continue on in the broadcast today, I just want to share with you a little bit about next week's show. I entitled this one, The Real Victims in a Cancel Culture. The Real Victims in a Cancel Culture. I don't know if you're familiar with this. It's kind of like all the rage right now, unfortunately. You talk about stigma and you talk about, people being ostracized. It's a phenomenon that occurs in today's world, today's society, whereby people often find themselves ostracized or excluded from, let's say, often the social media culture. Okay, but it actually goes much, much further than that. It's actually creating a significant psychological and emotional wound in people, whereby it directly affects the relationships. Okay, so I invite you to tune in next Friday for the real victims in a cancel culture. Well, I don't know if I've ever shared this with you. Part of me says that I did, but you know, it's always a great story to share with you again. But there is, if you ever get to meet me, just ask me to show you one day that the scar on my left thumb. This is more than just a conversation piece. This is something that was a very valuable lesson to me. And you talk about learning lessons the hard way. You know, this is something that, you know, I learned from, you know, what you shouldn't do on a construction site, as well as, you know, just a natural progression of healing that takes place, not only physically, but also spiritually. Okay, and this is when I was 17 years old, and I was working on a roofing project, and actually it was a mock roofing project, and it was designed to teach us students how to shingle a roof properly. And you know, my task was not up on the roof itself, but my task was down on the ground, and I was to cut smaller sections of the shingles so that they would fit at the end of each row. And it was about an hour before quitting time, and as, of course, with most avoidable accidents, I was in a hurry to finish the job. You know, my mind wasn't on my work, and you know, that just is ripe for, you know, problems, okay? So with my straight edge in one hand and my utility knife in the other, I began to score the section that needed to be cut, you know, these shingles. And about the fourth or fifth pass, the knife seemed to jump across that straight edge and right across my left thumb. And, quitting time came early for me that day because I finished the day in the emergency room getting about 7 or 8 stitches for my haste. Now, since that time, reflecting on that experience has taught me a lot about this natural progression of recovering from painful experiences, okay? Because whenever I was cut, I experienced the excruciating pain of a fresh wound. And something that I still remember to this day, that even in the days that followed, that whenever I accidentally bumped my thumb, you know how you just do it, you're not paying attention, and all of a sudden, whack, the pain and the blood reminded me that although the wound itself was stitched, healing was still a long way off. Okay, now, you know, decades later, I'm still reminded of that day, not because of the pain, but because of the scar. You know, and all of us have scars from previous wounds. You know, some are more obvious than others, such as a wound from surgery or an accident, or other scars, however, are not so obvious. You know, these scars have resulted from certain emotional or even spiritual wounds that are kept hidden deep down inside of us, within our heart, and within our soul. And very rarely do we permit others to get close to these wounds or to touch these wounds because perhaps we never healed from them in the first place. I mean, some wounds are still fresh, even from, let's say, 5, 10, or even 15 or more years ago. And in these incidences, a scar has never formed because we've never allowed the healing process to take place. Yeah, we're constantly poking at the wound or scratching open the scab and reliving all those painful emotional memories all over again. And in spite of our mother's warnings that, you know, it'll never heal unless you stop picking at it, we still apply these temporary band-aids of, let's say, self-medication. Or let's say we've repressed those memories, or we've denied that, or some other sedating relief that we can get our hands on. But you know, it's either way, you know, people are in search of healing, and trying to find healing from the emotional wounds of, let's say, also our loss and our grief. And one of the things, you know, we get caught up with, you know, wanting to hide our tears because of some embarrassment, or like, well, how can you still be grieving after all these years? And, you know, that doesn't do anything to provide us any kind of comfort. Okay. But, you know, one common misunderstanding that I run into every now and again is that, you know, once a person has worked through their losses or assimilated their losses, that they feel that they can go back to where they were before the loss, you know, back to some original emotional, spiritual, psychological state. And it's unfortunate because this return to the way things were rarely happens, because we're constantly shaped and changed by our losses. And once we have experienced the loss, our outlook on life is forever altered by the grief that we sustain. And the reason for this is because our assumptions about life, our expectations, and what we hope that life will turn out for us to be in the world in which we live have now been challenged, if not shattered. I mean, we all have been accustomed to the routines which define our daily existence. And over a year ago, you know, dealing with COVID and so forth, we were pretty content in our routines. And then COVID comes along and like, now what? Now what do we do? Why is this happening? How much more suffering do we have to go through? When's this pain going to end? And so forth. And in addition to those questions, and we realize the things that we go through, that we're never going to see ourselves or others or even the world the same as what we once did, because we're pulled into the task of trying to make sense out of new circumstances in light of the old. And yet, instead of assimilating our losses into everyday lives, many people still resist this healing by continuing to live in this prison of bitterness that's reinforced by, let's say, the familiar patterns of abuse, or let's say low self-esteem, or some sort of feeling of unworthiness or contempt or jealousy or strife or whatever it is. And instead of looking for the potential of being made better by our losses and allowing the tears that we shed to provide that nice, wonderful, complete healing process, we allow bitterness to harden our hearts and to keep others out. All the while, we're cementing the anguish and the pain inside. And so the challenge then is for us to discover the courage to redefine ourselves in light of our pain and grief. As I said at the beginning of the broadcast, you know, I'm a firm believer we come into this life with everything that we need. But how often we go through things that just create this, not a black cloud, but things just kind of hover over us and keep the very best parts of ourselves from coming out. You know, and yet it takes courage to pursue our authentic voice, our authentic self, because we might have to work through many, many, many layers of things that have simply kept our authentic selves down, or they might convince us that, yeah, we don't really have that genuine voice that we think that we do. And again, that's just wrong, because there is authenticity in each and every person, you know. But still, in you know, helping people, finding, first of all, the courage to redefine themselves in light of their pain and grief, you know, sooner or later, the conversation will come around to this question. Is this assimilation process, you know, and working through our grief or loss, you know, is this something we're able to do on our own? Or do we need help from others? Is this something that we can do on our own, or do we need help from people around us? happening. Well, in our house, we have this small plaque that reads, "Live to the Point of Tears." I'm sure you've seen it. It's very popular. And if you are a frequent shopper at Target, they're not all over the place, but you can find them. Okay. You can find them probably with the other pictures and lamps and so forth. So live to the point of tears. And, you know, I pass by this practically every day, and it has become a point of meditation for me, you know, where, again, to combat this idea or this notion from society that crying is a sign of weakness, so hide those tears. You know, first of all, crying is never a sign of weakness. But rather, it's a reminder not to hide ourselves from the world's problems, but rather engage people where they live. Celebrate with them. Cry with them. Live with them. And make no apologies for the tears you shed. Live to the point of tears. Because when we do that, we are living fully. We're living authentically. So whenever I look at my thumb these days, I see more than just a scar, you know, more than just a reminder of a painful time in my past. I mean, I was a kid, I was 17. But I also see a thumbprint, you know, something we all have in common, and no two thumbprints are alike. You know, and our thumbprints identify us as unique, among other characteristics. And these prints are one of the most distinguishable parts of our bodies. And, you know, hospitals record them as a means of identifying newborns and their mothers and fathers. And certain jobs require their applicants to get fingerprinted prior to employment. And even people who have been arrested have their prints taken as a matter of legal record. Okay, but all in all, when you think about it, our fingerprints can tell us a lot about us. Well, so do our scars. They identify what wounds we have suffered as a result of living to the point of tears. They identify what wounds we have suffered as a result of the past, you know, accidents or mistakes or surgeries or unfortunate mishaps of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, and the same could be said for, you know, our bereavement. We all experience loss and grief throughout our lives, but just as no two thumbprints are alike, so do no two people grieve in the same manner or react similarly to the, you know, to parts of the of, you know, the experience of loss. But you know, we've gotten better at this, I would say, overall as society, but we still have a long way to go. Society still puts out these messages of hide those tears, don't let it show, you know, swallow those tears, be a man, or, you know, you can just tough it out and, you know, be strong for others. And then we wonder why we have stomach problems, wonder why we cannot find our authentic voice and so forth. You know, in our losses, we may believe that what happens to us is just so exclusive, you know, that nobody has ever experienced what we've gone through. But we forget about the other side of the thumb, okay, so to speak, you know, and that is that, you know, that change and loss and death are universal. You know, they're all events and experiences that we all face because we exist, because we're human. And as universal as the events, we can never minimize another person's loss because it's still unique to them. Well, there's an ancient story that I am very fond of, and I come across it every now and then, but it just reminds me about this theme of the universality of death and dying, grief and mourning. Okay, there's an ancient story about a bereaved mother who brought her deceased child to a holy man to be healed. And she begged the master to have pity on her and return her child to life. And interestingly, the master agreed to do so, but only if she would first bring him a mustard seed from a house in her village where death had not been. Okay. And initially the woman was excited because, you know, his request seemed so simple. You know, and she thought, you know, oh, of course, you know, surely there has to be at least one house where death has not visited. Well, she comes down from the mountain. Finally, she arrived at the first house that she came to. She knocks on the door and she asked if they had any mustard seeds for her. You know, could she have a few? And she was delighted. She was overjoyed when she heard that the family had plenty to give. However, when this woman told the family that the seeds had to come from a household where death had not visited, well, the family told her that they buried their father a year before. And she said, okay, well, thank you for your time. And she went away disappointed, but yet she was still hopeful. And the woman moved to the second house, the next house, and asked if they could give her mustard seeds. And again, the family inside had plenty of seeds to give her. But again, when she heard that, they too buried a loved one, she couldn't accept the seeds. And it was on and on and on. The woman went from one house to another, searching for a family, a person who had been spared from death. But to her dismay, she couldn't find one. And it eventually hit her. She eventually realized that, you know, oh my gosh, the wisdom of the master. And that is that death comes to all. And silently, she went back up the mountain, found the master, and she claimed her child's body and returned home with him to bury him in peace. Well, many years ago, I met a Dr. Ken Doka, who had done extensive research in the area of hospice. And as we sat in his office at the College of New Rochelle in the Bronx, we talked about the importance of rebuilding our faith and philosophical assumptions that have been challenged by loss and grief. And what impressed me most about that conversation was how he explained how most of us live our lives according to our assumptions of how grief causes us to reexamine our core beliefs about how life should operate. You know, we get these messages, you know, and then we just continue to build our lives upon the assumptions of, let's say, how the world should work a certain way, or when and how God should answer our prayers, or when and how God should act, or matters of faith and obedience and rewards and punishment and so forth. We just build these assumptions. But we realize that when we experience the pain and loss, we are just never the same again. And it's actually the last thing to be healed in us are these assumptions, are, you know, the woundedness, the shattering of our expectations. And we come away maybe a little bit wiser. You know, we realize that, you know, maybe we need to see ourselves, others, the world, God, in a different light. Okay. Well, one of my favorite books is about an ancient story told of the spiritual journey of an Indian man called Siddhartha, who lived during the time of the Buddha. If you have never read Siddhartha, I highly recommend it. Okay. This is certainly a book that will take you inward to yourself. And within Buddhism, there is a belief that there is nothing fixed and permanent in this world. In other words, everything and everyone is subject to change. Or, as the Buddha taught, it's in this continuous becoming. And I like that, a continuous becoming. And we refer to this belief as impermanence. Okay? And there's an important analogy, or I should say a metaphor, that's often tied to this idea of impermanence. And if you've ever sat down beside a river and watched its flow, you're going to get the idea. Okay? We just sit there quietly and we just follow the water as it runs from point to point, and the water runs around rocks and fallen branches and then just finds the way of least resistance. It just keeps going. Nothing can stop it. And yet, at the same time, the river is not one continuous and unified flow, okay? Because the river of this moment is not going to be the same as the river for the next moment, and the moment after that, and the moment after that. And this is where the ancient saying from the ancient philosopher Heraclitus says, you cannot step into the same river twice, for the waters are ever flowing onto you. And this same philosophy can be applied to our lives, that none of us remain the same throughout our years. You know, we think that we're not changing, but we are. You know, various stages of our lives, from childhood to adulthood to old age, are just not the same any given time. We're in this constant state of flux, constant state of change. And the child, as we all know, is not the same when he or she grows up and becomes a young adult, or when they grow up and become elderly. And it's true that we live from moment to moment, but we tend to forget that each moment leads to the next. And impermanence and change are thus these undeniable truths of our existence. Okay? But just invite you to take inventory this week and consider how you live your life to the point of tears. What do you feel is holding back your tears? What pain have you experienced in this life that needs to be expressed? What pain that you've experienced in this life do you still feel the need to hide? It's not going away. We think just because we don't see it, just because we don't think about it, that it's going to be gone for good, but that's just simply not the case. But I encourage you to live to the point of tears, the happy tears, the sad tears, the gut-wrenching tears, the tears of celebration, the tears of joy, the tears of triumph. We have these tears for a reason, and they are meant to be shed. They not only restore us emotionally, physically, psychologically, and also provide spiritual healing for us, but they are just a healthy way to remind us of the healing that is always available to us. Okay. Well, I'm Dr. James Houck, and you have been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. I invite you to join me next week, same time, every Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Standard Time, when we're going to be looking at the cancel culture and just how detrimental that is for people psychologically and emotionally. So in the meantime, please be safe out there, and please live to the point of tears. Take care. Bye-bye.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Friday at noon Pacific Time on PBS Radio TV.